We're glad you're here today. Good morning. Today we're going to open the Word right now in John chapter 2. And you go, why are we in John chapter 2 and not in one of the childhood stories in the birth of Christ? And we're going to Christ as an adult in one of his miracles in John chapter 2. It's the wedding at Cana. It's the miracle of turning water into wine. Well, those of you who are from the Eastern Church, maybe Eastern Europe or the Middle East, know why. Because there's a festival called the Festival of Epiphany. That's on January 6th. That's when it's celebrated in the United States. And it is a time to celebrate four events in Christ's life. His birth, the coming of the wise men, his baptism as an adult, and this first miracle that he performs. And the early church brought together these four and said they come together because this is the first miracle, the first time we see his glory where others are around. Yes, it was there when he was baptized and the Spirit came on him, but this is one of those times. And so today we're going to look at that. We're going to do a shortened version today as well because we have a short church meeting afterwards. We'll be done by the whole thing before noon. So stay here afterwards. We're going to vote in some elders and do some other business. I'm going to give a short year-end report, but that'll happen afterwards. It's important that we listen to the word today, and Elizabeth's going to read the entire story in John chapter 2.
On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. And the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. And when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Thank you. It's a great little story of a wedding and a little miracle that occurs. But if we only look at this as a wedding and a little miracle, we have missed the whole point of this story, because this story is not about marriage and eating and drinking. That is just the particulars with which this story is set. But before we get to that, I want us to look at something that's happening today in our lives so that we can understand that as we look at this miracle and go, does it really apply to us 2,000 years later? Because we're not walking around expecting God to turn our water in our water bottles into something else, are we? We're not expecting that, nor is he going to do that, because that's not what he is about. This is not only about turning something into something else. It's far deeper than that. But I want you to write down three things. If you have a pen or your iPad, write down three things. There are three distortions that are occurring in modern America that I want us to look at, and then look how this miracle talks about that. When I read the Bible, I realize, though it was written thousands of years ago, it is as applicable today as it was then. And the reason is because it's God's word. It's not people's word. It's not Solomon's word. It's not John's word. It's not Moses' word. It's God's word. And God is eternal. And as time moves forward, we see that it's just as applicable today. So can I give you three things that are happening nowadays and you're seeing them, some of the things that Clay discussed a moment ago, but I want to put some feet around it and then look at the miracle based on that. Number one, it's the issue of authority versus preference. In the Bible and in much of the world, through much of our time and early in our nation, we had a belief that there was an authority in life, that you could actually look or point to authority. And in our case, as Christians, we pointed to the authority of the scriptures, which is the basis of our belief. And there was this great sense of authority in our lives. But lately, there's come this whole new concept of preference. Now, what is preference? Choice. Now, we love choice. We go to the store, and do you choose this or do you choose that? Do you go to McDonald's or do you go to Panera Bread? Do you go here or do you go there? Very interesting, and those are good choices, and do whatever you want to do in those. But realize everything we now have seems to boil down to a choice, even in our spiritual lives. And so I've had so many people come to me, and they come to you too and go, well, that is your choice. You have chosen Christianity. You have chosen Christ, as if that is just one of the choices around the world. And it has no authority based upon it because it is only a choice. I remember a few years ago, I had a friend come who lived in Africa, and he brought another friend who I'd never met from Africa, and he had never been out of his village, never been out of his village. So he comes to Florida to Boca Raton. This is a huge change. And so I wasn't aware of that, so I used to frequent this little deli, and I said, let's go to lunch, and we'll go to this little deli. It's no longer in business, but went to this deli, and it was the kind of deli that had a breakfast menu, a lunch menu, and a dinner menu. Have you ever been to those? And they throw all the menus on the table at one time, and they go, well, if you want breakfast, you can have breakfast. If you want lunch, if you want a big dinner, and they're like books, and you open them up, and so this guy from Africa looks at these books called menus and goes, I don't get it. He goes, at breakfast, I have meal. At lunch, I have rice. And at dinner, if I even have dinner, I have beans. He goes, there is no choice. We are so used to choice. Do you want hot? Do you want cold? Do you want a sandwich? Do you want this? Do you want that? That we have now placed that into our religious time to say, well, you know, Bill, you choose and your family has chosen because your mom and dad chose and et cetera. And you've chosen to go this way, but I choose to go that way. What we discover in this miracle is that the disciples believed in Christ's authority. I'm telling you the end before we even get to it. Ultimately, you have to decide, is coming to church and your understanding of Christianity a preference or is it an authority? And if it is just a preference for you, you need to come to grips with who Jesus Christ is this Christmas season, because he is either the authority, the one who's come from God, or he is an imposter. You cannot just prefer Jesus Christ. You either have to accept him or reject him. There is no middle ground, because either he is God or he was a madman. You cannot just say he was a good moral teacher. He was not a good moral teacher. He was God coming to teach us his morality. And if he didn't do that, then he is a bad moral teacher. So you can't just prefer it. But our whole country, our whole Western society, Europe, everywhere around the world is now saying it's just a preference. I prefer New Age. I prefer nothing. You prefer Christ. Come to grips with the reality. There is a right way. We're going to get to that later on. And John, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. If he's not the way, and if he's not the truth, then he's a liar. And you have to come to grips with that. Number two, another distortion in our world is this, is that our faith is privately engaging, but publicly irrelevant. You hear me say this a lot. This is probably the biggest thing that people say. They go, okay, it's all right that you have this faith. You know, I'm really excited that you guys have this faith. You're raising your family with this faith. Oh, you go to a great church. They give away a lot of money. They're a good corporate citizen. That is good. Come into this building and worship your God. But when you go out of this building, they say, it is totally irrelevant. Do not bring your faith into your workplace. Do not bring your faith into school. Do not bring your faith into the community. Do not bring it into your business. Do not do any of that because it's totally irrelevant. And I have to say, that is a lie from the pit of hell. And if you believe that only having faith here, it is easy to have faith in this room. For goodness sakes, these people coming forward, loving Jesus, these people singing here, were in an air-conditioned cushioned seat. You had coffee before you walked in. You fellowshiped with some great people. There were people in the parking lot, nice and smiling, greeting you as you came in. What is not to like? But that is not what faith is about. That's community. That is not faith. That's community. And I love community. I'm all for community. But understand that our faith is more than sitting and fellowshipping and hugging each other and drinking coffee with friends. And if it is not, then it is irrelevant privately as well. I believe our faith is personal, but it should not be private. Your faith should infuse your entire life. And this miracle at Cana, and I'm giving you the end at the beginning, this miracle integrated Christ's work into the everyday life of a wedding. There was nothing more common than a wedding. Now, let me describe the wedding at Cana, because we have a different concept. I have a son getting married, God willing, in the next 2 months to a lovely lady from our church. And what will happen at this wedding that comes up in February is we're all going to assemble in the chapel across the street, and my son's going to be standing at the altar next to me and a couple other men. And then all of a sudden, the lady's going to walk into the church, and all the people will stand up, will come, and we'll have the ceremony. That is not how it was done in the olden times. It was the total opposite. In the olden times, the man came in, not the woman. But there wasn't a church building, so what would happen is the man would come to the home of the woman, and he would come unannounced. So they would become betrothed months earlier, or engaged as we would say now. Many times it was arranged. Yes, they were arranged marriages. There are marriages today that are arranged. When I go to India, I asked a couple, I go, do you have a love marriage or an arranged marriage? That is a common question to ask people from different parts of the world. This would be an arranged marriage. This would be a marriage where the man lived in Cana, a little village next door to Nazareth, where Mary and Jesus were from. They were having this. At some point in time, the man and all his, what we would call groomsmen, he would call assistants, would go to the town or the home of the bride and would go get her and bring her back to his home. At which time there would be a ceremony, not too long, a short ceremony, but then everybody from that little village would come over to this village and they would have a week-long celebration of the coming together of these two families. And it would be literally a week long when this would happen. I never understood how a whole town could come from a whole nother town until I was in North Carolina one time. Is anybody from North Carolina? Oh yeah, there are some people. It's a strange place, my friends. It is a strange place. So we had a home in North Carolina, summer home. My parents said, let's go in the fall for a couple of weeks and see the leaves change. I go, okay, whatever. And so I'm in high school watching the leaves change. And so I said, let's go to a high school football game. High school football in North Carolina is different than anywhere else in the world. A little school in this little town of 2,000 that we were in, and they were playing a little town from another part of the county, but the football stadium in this little town had 10,000 seats. And I would go by and I'd go, 10,000 seats, we're in the middle of nowhere with 2,000 people. They go, well, it will be filled on Friday night. I go, why will it be filled? Because everybody in the county is going to come to watch this football game. And sure enough, I went and there were 10,000 people in this town of 2,000 or 3,000 people because the other town came with 3,000 or 4,000 and then the other towns came and it was filled with 10,000 people to watch a bunch of 17-year-olds play football. Well, that is the concept here. The whole town would come. These are villages of 300 or 400 or 500. They're not big towns like we see in Israel now. And they would come and it would be a week-long celebration. That's why there had to be those huge jars filled. Why did the wine run out? Because there were hundreds and hundreds of people at this thing. And they stayed for days. And it ran out. And so six jars, each of them what were about 20 to 30 gallons. That's this big. That was the size. Why didn't he just do a couple quarts or liters of wine if it was just two little families getting together? Because it was everybody. At the end of the day, we see this miracle of Christ working in the everyday event of a wedding. Nowadays, Christ works in your everyday events. Can I just say that? He works in your everyday events. We think the miracles are this: healing from cancer, healing from heart disease, you name it. Those kind of things. That is a miracle, and those miracles happen. But also, there are miracles that occur just in the everyday of your life. Have you ever seen a miracle occur, by the way? See, we think it's got to be water into wine. It's got to be you have cancer spot, and then there's no cancer spot. Those happen. I remember about 15 years ago, my son Greg and I went to Cuba. You know, you weren't allowed to go to Cuba back then, so we went to the Bahamas and kind of worked our way into Cuba, and we drove the whole distance of Cuba, 650 miles. I wanted to see this country I grew up next to, and I had never seen it, and my son was turning 15. I said, let's go to Cuba. So we go to Cuba, and we're driving around. We met some people there, and we're all together. One night, we decided to go to this church. They said, go to this church. It's a great church. And so the other guys that were with in the other car had to do something else, so they were going to come later. So our translator, Greg, and I go to this church. It was very large, probably as large as the center section, which is huge for an evangelical church in Cuba. And it was there, and I walked in, and I realized I was walking into 1959. It was 1959. It hadn't been painted since 1959. The roof hadn't been fixed. The seats hadn't been done. Nothing had been done since 1959. This is now 2002 or whatever it was. And we go in there, and they're praying. It was an intense prayer service. So I didn't understand it, but I felt the Spirit of God there. So I'm asking my translator, what's going on? And he said, they're praying that God would restore this building so that they could grow even more. I said, wow. I said, how long have they been praying this prayer? And he said, dozens of years. Every Wednesday night before church, they pray for this prayer. I'm talking intense, crying out to God. And Greg and I are in the back watching this thing. And listen, but I felt the Spirit of God. That was over. The church service began. Our friends arrived. They knew none of what had just occurred the hour before. They set up towards the front. We were still in the back. And the friends were there. And I noticed, he didn't speak Spanish either, the people there. And I noticed during the service that he's weeping the entire service. Weeping. At the end of the service, we got together and we're standing with the pastor. He knew nothing of the needs of that church. And he said to the pastor, a few months ago, one of my family members died. I inherited money. I've been praying to God what I should do with this money. And tonight, I know, I need to give it to you. Now, giving money in Cuba took a long, you had to send it to Canada and back, all those issues. He said, but I want to fix your roof and your floor and your stage, which was crumbling. He says, I want to do it in the name of my parents. And the pastor just weeps and weeps, and he goes, "Why are you weeping?" He goes, "We've been praying for this for dozens of years." And then the pastor did this. He didn't thank the man. He thanked God, because it was God who did the work. You see, it was God who prompted those people to pray. It was God who prompted that man. It was God who prompted those parents to give it to a responsible son. It was God who did all the work. God did a miracle that night. And Greg and I sat back there saying, "We saw a miracle occur." No, it wasn't the healing of a lame person. It wasn't the healing of cancer, but it was the healing of a man who had been given the responsibility, the talents, the gifts, the money to do something responsibly with, and he chose to do it. And God got the glory, not the man, not the prayers, but the Almighty God. That's what the miracle was. See, the miracle is seeing the glory of God in all this, in the everyday of life. And then number three, in our society, there is a shift from the supernatural, and I use a big word, secularism. You could call it naturalism, you could call it atheism, you could call it whatever you want, but there's this whole concept nowadays that the supernatural does not occur, does not even exist. It's not that he exists and you don't know him, it doesn't even exist. And you and I have to scream out against that. We believe the supernatural exists. The disciples believed it, the servants believe it, his mother believed it. They saw the glory of God. And I believe this season of Christmas, you and I need to see the glory of God. You've seen enough of the glory of men and women. You've seen enough of the glory of whatever, your own efforts. Look out and ask, "God, I want to see your glory. I want to see your glory." Now let's look at this miracle very quickly. Verse 1, it was the third day. Now, if you knew your math, there were 4 days in chapter 1. This is the third day. This is the seventh day of Jesus' ministry. It's only the seventh day. The first 4 days, we remember, five disciples followed Jesus. John, Andrew, Peter, Philip, and Nathaniel. That's what we talked about last week. They're the disciples sitting with him. The other ones haven't been called yet. So there's five disciples most likely sitting there, and the mother of Jesus was there. It doesn't say she was invited. It says she was there. I believe she was there because she was one of the family members. She's there. You know, some people are invited to the wedding, and some people are just there. You know, Aunt Matilda is there, right? You got to invite Aunt so-and-so there because she's family. Mary is family. She's there. But Jesus is probably some cousin, obviously. And so he was invited, as was his disciples. They're sitting there, and the wine ran out. I told you why the wine ran out. Too many people. They didn't predict it. And this is a time of shame. You and I live in a culture of guilt. America's a culture of guilt. You apologize, and you go, "Oh, I'm sorry, we ran out, we're done." And you would go, "Oh, no problem, I'll just go out to McDonald's and finish the meal." Well, there, it was shame. Those of you who come from shame-based societies know that it would have shamed the family, it would have shamed the bride and bridegroom, it would have shamed the entire village. So let's say they came from Nazareth, we don't know this, but they came from somewhere. The whole town, if it were Nazareth, would be mocking this town. They can't even provide wine at their weddings. See, shame. So there's this whole shame-based thing. And so Mary goes, "They have no wine." And Jesus says, "Woman," don't get over impressed with that word woman. People go, "Why did he call his mother woman?" Well, because that's what they did back then. You'll find Jesus calling all ladies women. Woman. I mean, it was just a natural thing. Nowadays, you don't say woman because it's disrespectful or whatever. Back then, it was just what you did. She was a woman, he called her a woman. So don't think, "Oh, he was disrespectful." But he says these words, "What does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." This is beautiful. "My hour has not yet come." In John chapter 12, verse 23, he says, "My hour has come." When he was ready to go to the cross, he says, "My hour has come." He says, "Right now, my hour has not come." What he was saying is, "Mom, you're no longer under authority. I'm no longer under your authority. I'm under the authority of God, and my hour has not yet come. Well, his mom says these words, and I want you to underline them. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Can I just suggest this? Do whatever God tells you. Do whatever Christ tells you. Just do it. When you're praying, Christ tells you that moral impulse, go do it. They said, just do whatever he tells you. Now, there were 6 stone water jars. The reason it's stone, because clay water jars could be contaminated. Stone water jars were pure. It was for the purification, so they were stone. He makes that point that these were pure water jars. There was nothing in it, so no one could say, oh, you know, there was something else in it that made the water taste like wine. It was pure water. Now, there may have been a little, there may have been empty, totally empty, whatever. They fill them up. And he turns the water into wine. Now, my grandmother, who was an attender of here for years, she died years ago. She had a little mischief in her. And she lived in Boca when Boca was a village, when Palmetto Park Road was a path. And so she lived on the east side of Palmetto Park Road, and they had a picnic one day with everybody invited from the village of Boca Raton. This is about 1923, and everybody's invited, and my grandmother, Floy, was in charge of bringing the drinks. Now, we are teetotalers in our family, which means we don't drink liquor, so she brought lemonade. Well, so how do you bring lemonade for 200 or 300 people? So she went to the hardware store and bought, if the older people would know this, a zinc tub. Remember the zinc tubs? That's a tin tub that you used to, you could wash things in. Brand new tub. I don't even know if it's made of zinc. That's what they called it. But it's a silver tub, about this big, held about 30 gallons. And she filled it, and then she, you know, she didn't have Crystal Light. She actually had to do the things, you know. And so she was drinking a little lemonade. She was tired of the lemonade. She pours it all in. And then she gives it to everyone. Well, what she didn't realize was the zinc, or whatever it is, around the thing, the acidity of the lemons, and that went, and everybody in town got sick. The entire town was violently sick. You know this kind of sick? Except my mother-in-law, my grandmother, excuse me. My grandmother was the only one in town who was not sick because she drank the lemonade when it was pure, before she poured it into the vessel, into the zinc tub. So they thought she had done it because she kind of was mischievous to begin with, but she promised to her dying day that it was an accident. So I don't really know if it was or wasn't. He says here that it was stone because nothing could come with it to give it a taste. For instance, it wasn't already in wine jugs, where there could be some residue of wine, then it all mixes up. And this is a true miracle of water turning into wine. You can make a lot of examples out of that, but he turns it. So they took it, and he says now in verse 8, take those jars, fill it with water, draw some water out, and give it to the master of feast. So they did that, and the master of the feast tasted it and said, wow, this is the best wine. And it's an amazing thing that happens here. Only, it shows us here, only the servants, Mary, and the disciples knew that there was a miracle. Jesus doesn't show off this miracle to the hundreds around him, the hundreds from Cana, the hundreds from the other town, or even the master of the feast. None of them know it. He gives the credit to the bridegroom's family that they kept the best for last. Very humble act of Christ. But now verse 11 is key. Verse 11 is the point of the whole thing. This is the first of his signs. It doesn't say miracles, it says signs. Now, what's the difference between a miracle and a sign? Because Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when they talk about walking on water, feeding the 5,000, all these great things, they call them miracles. But John calls them signs. There is a difference. And here, let me give you a definition. Can you put that up? Of a miracle focuses on the supernatural event. Jesus walks on water. That's a miracle. Jesus turns the water into wine. That's a miracle. It is a miracle. Healing, wind, blindness, food, etc. It's a miracle. But what is a sign? A sign is a miracle, so it is a miracle, that focuses on the person, Jesus Christ in this case, on the person and the meaning behind the event. You see, so many people get caught up on the turning the water into wine. This is not turning water into wine. That's the miracle. But John says there's a sign behind this. A sign points beyond itself, meaning the miracle, to something that is greater. Go back to chapter verse 11. This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. That's the important thing. The purpose of this sign was so that his inner core of people understood who he was. That he was not just a good speaker that had come out of the wilderness with John the Baptist and was now had a Messiah complex, but his true glory was seen. And what occurred after his glory was seen? Do you know? It says here at the end, his disciples believed in him. Now that goes directly back to the previous chapter, if you remember last week, when Nathanael and Jesus in verse 46 and following of chapter 1, when Jesus says, "Do you believe in me?" to Nathanael. Do you know there's no answer there? We don't know if Nathanael believed in Jesus at that point. He did follow him, but did he believe in him? We don't know that until right here. When he did the sign, he showed his glory to those five disciples, his mother and those servants, and then we know that they believed in him. You see, a miracle is not about the miracle. The miracle is not about the feeding of the 5,000, because at the end of the day, all that happens when you have been fed by a miracle is that you want another miracle tomorrow. And we're going to discover that all those people, all they wanted was another miracle to follow yesterday's miracle. And that's a problem we have today, even with Christians. Something God does, and all they care about is the miracle that occurs, and not a care about the miracle worker behind the miracle. And this sign, John says, is facing us, pointing us to the glory of Christ. And I think it's important to understand that as we look at Christmas, as we come to Christmas now, the glory of Christ. Not just the baby born so that he could do good speeches and good miracles and then die on a cross. It is his glory. And that is who Jesus is.